This is Dwight Smith. I'm of counsel here at Covington, where I practice in the bank regulatory and finance space. I hope everyone's safe and well. For those of you who may be at home, like me, you at least have a 30-minute respite from whatever else is going on. And if you happen to be in the office, then maybe two, it's another respite. So thank you for joining our financial services teleconference series, Taking Stock, the Financial Services and Regulatory Landscape Today. This is the 10th session in our weekly series, with additional presentations on the impact of COVID-19 related policy measures on the financial system in Europe, the CFPB during and after the COVID-19 pandemic, new regulatory developments affecting small dollar lending, CARES Act implementation and legislative developments, and preparations for federal bank regulatory oversight and enforcement related to coronavirus responses. We're very excited to be able to offer this series to our clients and friends. Before we start, I've got a couple of housekeeping items. First, on CLE. For those of you interested in CLE credit, today's program is approved for 0.5 credits in New York and California. Affirmation forms were linked in the reminder notice you received for today's call. If you'd like CLE credit, you will need to record the affirmation code we will share towards the end of the call and return the form to our colleague, Elizabeth Christiani. Her information is on the form, and she will revert with a certificate of attendance in due course. Second, we would welcome any questions you may have during the program. Please forward any questions you have to Al McManus at amcmanus@cov.com. That's amcmanus@cov.com. We will strive to answer as many questions as possible, but we would be pleased to connect you on an individual basis following the presentation. A final note, you should have received supporting materials, at least electronically. I think those would be helpful to review, but we will not be reviewing them in any detail during this presentation. Now, on with our discussion. I'd like to cover two sets of issues today. We'll probably spend the bulk of our time on the actions that the federal departments and agencies and the GSEs have taken in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. I'll review consumer-facing matters, compliance issues, and action or inaction with respect to liquidity in the market for and the ability of non-bank servicers to make payments on mortgage-backed securities. After that, I'll turn to two ongoing activities with the Federal Housing Finance Agency and Fannie and Freddie. Those two things are the recently proposed capital rules and the transition from LIBOR to SOFR. I suppose a word of warning, will be pretty wide-ranging and covering lots of agencies as they sort of appear in the in this series of events. I'll try to minimize the sort of alphabet soup, but I guess just be forewarned. So starting off, a central concern of Congress and the agencies regarding the effect of the COVID-19 pandemic has been the ability of mortgage borrowers to repay their loans and the downstream effects of that probability. The CARES Act contains two important provisions for borrowers: a moratorium on foreclosures and evictions, and forbearance on missed payments. Now, on the former, the foreclosure moratorium that the CARES Act provision itself has expired and was not extended in the Paycheck Protection Program and Health Care Enhancement Act that was passed in April. The CARES Act provision, Section 4022C2, expired 60 days after the enactment of the CARES Act on May 17th. Nevertheless, it remains a useful reference point, since various moratoria continue in effect through the FHFA, which has extended the federal moratorium through June 30th, and through state law. The state laws vary both as to coverage. Some deal with judicial foreclosures and others with non-judicial foreclosures, and the time period. Some state moratoria will go well beyond June 30th. It is also important to bear in mind that while the various federal provisions are limited to federally backed mortgages, state law may reach a broader class of mortgages. On a related point, evictions also are suspended, although not quite on a sector-wide basis. The suspension lasts for 120 days generally, but is limited to rental properties that secure a federally backed mortgage or multifamily mortgage loan. The moratorium can last longer if the multifamily borrower requests forbearance from its servicer. In that case, the moratorium on evictions will last as long as the forbearance period. To a more complicated topic, forbearance. To grasp the scope of forbearance, some facts are in order. According to the most recent data from the Mortgage Bankers Association, as of May 24th, 4.2 million homeowners are in forbearance, which represents 8.46% of mortgage servicers' portfolios overall. Ginnie Mae loans, that is, FHA and VA loans, have the highest percentage of forbearance, 11.82%. By contrast, the forbearance percentage of Fannie and Freddie loans is 6.39%, while private label securities and portfolio loans are at 9.67%. In all cases, the percentages have been increasing week by week, but the rate of increase is slowing. On to the CARES Act, which is the governing statute, although the federal agencies and the GSEs had begun forbearance before then. As you doubtless know, Section 4022 of the CARES Act provides a nearly automatic forbearance period up to 180 days with an extension of up to another 180 days. The only statutory condition is an affirmation by a borrower that he or she is experiencing a financial hardship during the COVID-19 emergency. Upon a receipt of a request with that attestation, the servicer, quote, shall with no additional documentation, close quote, provide the forbearance. The servicer also may not charge late or other penalty fees. It may charge only those fees that it would charge a borrower who remains current. Similar forbearance is available to multifamily borrowers, but the maximum period is 90 days, and the servicer must document the multifamily borrower's financial hardship. In practice, this may not be quite so simple. Fannie and Freddie require a servicer to perform some level of due diligence and have developed model scripts for servicers that delve into the nature of the hardship. In addition, and adding to the complications, while the CARES Act provides the 360-day relief, it does not address what happens afterwards. This, a borrower must negotiate with the servicer. There is a hierarchy of methods to restore currency to the loan. A borrower can make a lump sum payment of the forborne payments at the end of the forbearance period. He or she can spread out the missed payments over an agreed upon period of time, or the loan as a whole can be modified. Fannie and Freddie have introduced a fourth possibility. The borrower makes the missed payments at the end of the loan, which in effect would mean an extension of the loan if it goes to maturity. Now, None of these are foreordained for a particular borrower, so there will be some discussions and negotiations. On the flip side of the forbearance coin, the federal regulators, that is, the three banking agencies, the Fed, the OCC, and the FDIC, as well as the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, have taken a number of steps to relieve some of the compliance burdens on lenders and servicers. Without doing an exhaustive review, a variety of regulatory and supervisory changes are in effect. For servicers subject to RESPA, the CFPB has said that it will not take enforcement action on a large number of reporting requirements. For those of you familiar with RESPA, the CFPB has said that CARES Act forbearance is a, quote, short-term forbearance program, which means that it is exempt from certain loss mitigation requirements. In addition, the CFPB considers a request for forbearance and, quote, incomplete loss mitigation application. Such an application entails an acknowledgement notice from the servicer within 5 days, but that 5-day period would not apply in these cases. I note, as a side note, that the CFPB has issued further guidance on how it will supervise and enforce a variety of consumer compliance issues. In general, it is effectively loosening and, I suppose, treating with some forbearance itself the actions of lenders and servicers. So whenever a compliance issue may arise, it is worth double-checking to see just what the CFPB has recently said about it. Next, regarding credit reporting, a servicer must continue to report a borrower who is in forbearance as current on the mortgage, just provided the borrower was current when the forbearance period began. There are two items for banks and other FDIC-insured depository institutions. First, the banking agencies have encouraged banks to work with their borrowers on loan modifications. This is not limited to mortgage loans. And they've also advised they will not take enforcement action in a variety of situations where loan modifications are taking place. This is much along the lines of what the CFPB has said. In addition, according to the agencies, banks are not required to report modified loans as troubled debt restructurings. And finally, again, with respect to the banking agencies, they have made clear that forbearance will be a plus in a CRA evaluation, particularly where the forbearance is to low and moderate income borrowers in low to moderate income neighborhoods and in certain rural communities and disaster areas. I would note that you may have seen a week or so ago that the OCC by itself released a new CRA rule. That doesn't come into play here because that rule wouldn't take effect until 2023. So the agencies still are working jointly under the existing rules. I'd like to turn now more specifically to the servicing side. And the fundamental question is whether servicers, and particularly non-bank servicers, will be able to make payments pursuant to their mortgage bonds. If they cannot, Fannie, Freddie, and Ginnie Mae will be called on to support the securities, and the affected servicers will almost certainly fail. Now, none have, and perhaps risks are declining as the rate of forbearance requests declines. Still, a servicer is likely to regard the federal response to the risk as at the very best, mixed. So far, a few resources have or have not emerged. First, the Federal Reserve, now a source of liquidity for many financial and commercial businesses, has no facility available to non-bank servicers. Media reports suggest that that has been considered, and the Treasury Borrowing Advisory Committee has recommended the establishment of one. But nothing further has come to pass. Of course, the Fed at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York purchases agency mortgage-backed securities, but that would not have necessarily much benefit for the non-bank servicers. And as for the bank servicers, they do have access to the discount window, which is something that the non-bank servicers do not. Second, I'd note that the FHFA has so far rejected appeals from the servicers for relief. Now, about 2 months ago, Director Calabria was reported to have said that in the absence of relief over the next 2 months, which is to say absent relief by now, there would be failures. Again, so far, so good, but that is not a resource for the non-bank servicers. Third, the Treasury Department has established the Task Force on Non-Bank Mortgage Liquidity to report to the Financial Stability Oversight Council on these matters. As an aside, it's probably noteworthy that the FSOC is looking at this issue. They are, of course, focused on so-called systemic risk issues, and this raises the obvious question, which the FSOC hasn't really answered, as to what sort of systemic risk the non-bank servicers may offer. Now, again, moving back to the FHFA, at the moment they seem not to think that there is a systemic risk, but we shall see. Now, this task force has made a couple of presentations to FSOC, and at the most recent meeting, which occurred a few weeks ago, the FSOC apparently considered forms of relief, but its only public statements so far are to the effect that it will continue to monitor the situation. Finally, Ginnie Mae has established a facility for servicers of Ginnie Mae loans, the Pass-Through Assistance Program, or PTAP. This seems to have attracted not very much interest, possibly because of the relatively high rate Ginnie is charging, and it is, as of today, it is 5.66%. And as I believe, as of May 30th, Ginnie Mae had made only just over $4 billion in advances under that facility. So that is that for the COVID-19 materials. And I'd like to turn to the proposed capital rules and the LIBOR SOFR issues briefly. And even before getting to that, I would note that there have been two developments yesterday and today at the FHFA that may be of interest. One is that yesterday the FHFA published a credit risk transfer spreadsheet, which is based on the reproposed capital rule, and that naturally would be of interest to anyone involved with the credit risk transfer program for Fannie and Freddie. Secondly, just this morning, the FHA finalized the housing goals that will take effect in 2021. Now, the week before Memorial Day, the FHFA issued a reproposal of the 2018 capital rule proposal, and it substantially reworked that earlier proposal. Among other things, the reproposal has a goal not contemplated in the 2018 proposal, and that is the termination of the conservatorships and the privatization of Fannie and Freddie. When the capital rules are finalized, and it's hard to tell what that time frame may be at the FHFA right now, those final rules should tell us how far Fannie and Freddie have to go and how much money they will still have to raise. As you know, Fannie and Freddie began to be permitted to keep more of their earnings last fall up to a new limit. That retention is still ongoing given the level of their earnings. And it's be interesting to see how those retained earnings measure up against what the capital rules will require. I suspect there will be a pretty sizable gap. When we say that the FHFA has reworked the 2018 proposal, that's evident in many respects, but the FHFA has emphasized two elements. First, the reproposal increases the quantity and quality of the regulatory capital at the GSEs. Second, the reproposal includes a number of changes that are designed to mitigate the pro-cyclicality of the aggregate risk-based capital rules. Now, the reproposal is based on Basel III to a significant extent, and therefore it's going to be somewhat familiar to banks. The reproposal provides for three risk-based capital ratios, for example, which in fact are identical to the risk-based capital rules that banks and bank holding companies have to abide by. However, in other respects, the reproposal increases capital requirements in ways that do not have a specific source in Basel III. For example, in addition to a capital conservation buffer on top of the risk-based capital requirements, which is something that Basel III provides for, the FHA reproposal introduces a capital buffer for the leverage ratio. Now that is, for example, one of the countercyclical elements of the capital rules. A couple of other points to keep in mind. If they were banks, Fannie and Freddie would generally be considered large enough to be so-called advanced approaches banks and subject to the advanced approaches requirements in Basel III. And naturally enough, so in the reproposal, the FHA identifies both of them as advanced approaches institutions, and they would be required, like large banks, to assess capital requirements both using the so-called standardized approach, which is in the reproposal, as well as their own internal materials, and then, like the banks, take the more conservative approach. Second, there's an interesting countercyclical adjustment to the mark-to-market LTV ratio that is used for determining home values. There is also now a floor of 15% on the risk weights for mortgage loans. Those risk weights are probably slightly lower overall than, or the resulting value of risk-weighted assets is probably a little lower for Fannie and Freddie than those mortgage loans would be risk-weighted for banks. The proposal also provides an operational risk capital element, and that has a floor of 15 basis points of adjusted total assets. I do want to add a word on private mortgage insurance. And for that, the reproposal modestly reduces the risk weight for low down payment loans with private mortgage insurance. And that assumes that the insurance provider meets the GSE insurer eligibility standards. Now, For our last item, the LIBOR transition, before I do that, I'd like to read the CLE code. In order to receive CLA credit, this code must be recorded on the remote attendee affirmation form. And bear in mind that capitalization matters. The code is uppercase L, uppercase J, the number 9B, and a lowercase b. Again, that's an uppercase L, uppercase J, 9, and lowercase b. Or if you use the NATO alphabet, it's uppercase Lima, uppercase Juliet, the number 9, and lowercase Bravo. Now, on LIBOR, what I'd like to just mention is that last week, on May 28th, the GSEs launched joint LIBOR transition playbooks and FAQs on their website. Participants are expected to discontinue most of their LIBOR index products by the end of 2020. The playbook includes a timeline and series of milestones. I have not tried to go through it in detail. Those should correspond to the timeline and the milestones in the that the Alternative Reference Rate Committee has developed, and the at least the ARRC announced their support for what Fannie and Freddie are doing. So that concludes our presentation today. You can find additional information about our financial services teleconference series on the events page of our website, www.cove.com, and on our COVID-19 toolkit page. Links to both are included in the meeting materials. Again, thank you for joining us today. If you have any questions following the call, please feel free to reach out with any questions you may have. Thanks again.